in Navajo, we say Yatka for hello, and and Hajonga. So yeah, well, thank you all. We're at the last moment here, and I thank you for all the callers, and I hope that we can really begin to understand what we can do in this matter. I mean, here we had this sweep with the electoral sweep just a few weeks ago, and it feels like once again the Dems are just letting it all go and capitulating. And yeah, I think that we can actually use this moment to make change and to change the leadership in the party and to really get the energy together to really begin primarying people. And I think the issues that led to the electoral sweep, which is all, cost of living issues, I think those issues are not going away, certainly not with the decisions being made by the Republican Party, to make things harder for Americans, especially with medical costs. So anyway, thank you so much. This has been Jacqueline Keeler with Wednesday Talk Radio.
Benefit plan. Join us, boy, ain't it nice. Join us, take my advice. If you're lacking control and authority, come with me and hunt down minorities. Join ICE.
CFLB. This is KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
We were rough and rowdy there. There weren't any Girl Scouts at CBGB's. There really wasn't. It was a rough crowd, man. It really was.
I'm Jillian Jonas from WBAI Radio in New York, and today we're playing excerpts from This Ain't No Disco, This Is CBGB, our audio documentary about the historic music club CBGB and Omphug, ground zero for the seminal punk rock and new wave movement. CBGB is acknowledged as the place where punk rock was born, making what would become an indelible mark on modern music and on New York City history and culture. This iconic club has been credited with creating a completely unique subset of rock and roll. The series focuses on the first wave of this new music, approximately from 1973 to 1978.
It was amazing because the people who were there were just so really fun and interesting and really were so serious. Like Patty said, everyone had a library card, they were thinking on their feet, and everyone in the audience was a band member, and so everyone would watch each other and go, and learn. Like Patty, she read a lot. She studied Morrison. She studied her idols, but she was just well-read. But so was everybody else. It was just a fabulous place.
You just heard it from musician Dear France, an early CBGB employee, referring to one of the club's breakout artists, Patty Smith, who's been called the godmother or high priestess of punk.
It's a ray, but I think it's sad. It's much too bad that our friends can't be with us today.
CBGB officially opened in late December of 1973. I've embarked on this project because of several reasons, including the club's cultural and historical significance in general, and specifically to the New York City music scene. I'm a native Manhattanite who was fortunate enough to grow up during the 1970s and 80s, when the city was still the city, a mix of cultures and classes, and not a homogenous, gentrified version of what was. I also created the program because of the fixation on things like what the club's name means. For the record, it's country, bluegrass, and blues, and other music for uplifting gourmandizers. Furthermore, there's been a tendency to focus on only the most famous bands associated with CBGB, including the Ramones.
Five miles, different from the past, Jackie the punch, Judy the rush.
and Talking Heads. I believe many bands at the time continue to be underrated or overlooked. To name just a few, here's the Laughing Dogs. And the Dictators.
I can't stand my neighbors. They're screaming all the time. If I wasn't blasting Sister A, I would lose my mind.
I live in the city. I breathe dirty air.
CBGB was the brainchild of a singular man with an eclectic background, Hilly Kristal. Kristal himself was an accomplished musician with extensive experience working in the entertainment industry. The following is from an interview with Stephen Hager, in which Hilly spoke about some of his musical accomplishments.
Lead the violin, studied in Philadelphia Conservatory, concertized briefly as violinist, started studying voice for opera, ended up singing at Radio City Music Hall, sang folk music, recorded singing folk or folk-type music.
Hilly was a huge jazz fan and managed the famed Village Vanguard in the 50s and 60s, where he worked with some of the greats at the time, like the Modern Jazz Quartet, Cannonball Adderley, Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, and Lambert Hendricks and Ross. Kristal also co-founded the Rheingold Beer Central Park Music Festival in the 1960s with promoter Ron Delsner. For We Gen Xers, that series was the basis for what eventually transformed into the Dr. Pepper Concert Series, which moved to Pier 84 along the Hudson River in 1981. Lee Kristal's vision focused on original music. In fact, it was a prerequisite. This was a time when cover bands were the rule, not the exception. Original music, especially in New York, was scarce. Hilly wanted to create a space where unsigned and unknown bands were welcome.
He opened the club to give people a place to play,
explains former CBGB Day manager Susanna Ryan. Ryan worked in that capacity for more than 4 years during the 1970s.
He really believed in people expressing themselves through music. So when it ended up not being country and bluegrass, he didn't have a problem with that. He just wanted it to be original.
Many people are unaware that Kristal's musical criteria ended up creating a legacy and an incredibly diverse music scene. For example, Orchestra Luna, a cabaret rock band.
When you dance, I love you. When you dance, I love you.
Located in what was considered an industrial section on Manhattan's infamous Bowery, part of the Lower East Side now called the East Village, CBGB's neighborhood worked on several levels. Because the area was virtually abandoned at night, founder Kristal and CBGB's were able to evolve organically with little to no interference from outsiders like the NYPD or angry neighbors complaining about noise. Another of those early CBGB's bands was the Mumps, who formed in 1973 and fronted by the late Lance Loud. For those who don't know who he is, look him up, as he's an important figure in American pop culture. Mumps guitarist Rob Dupre talks about his personal experience when he got to New York and CBGB.
New York was more scary then. First, I was new to New York, and then also, it hadn't really been gentrified. The Bowery is kind of wild. A lot of empty buildings and stuff like that. Back then, the Bowery was still the Bowery of 1940s fame. It was derelict, abandoned, and winos were laying all over the street and stuff.
During what's considered CBGB's heyday in the 1970s, four groups were unofficially referred to as the M bands because each one's name began with the letter M. The Mumps was one. The Bowery, specifically, and the East Village more broadly, were the perfect places for something fresh, something that would become groundbreaking, based simply on its own history. Punk magazine creator John Holmstrom elaborates.
The Bowery, they had an amazing Windows display poster, and they highlighted all these different aspects of American culture that originated in the Bowery. The first tattoo parlor, the first baseball club, W.C. Fields, Houdini, the list is too long to list. You know, Charlie Parker and the Five Spot was on St. Mark's. Beatniks were here. Jazz was here. Every cultural movement in America either started or became popular in New York and especially around the area of the Bowery. That great book by Luke Sante, Low Life. It's not the high culture. It's the low culture, the popular culture. It was kind of sad, and I think one reason people look back on CBGB so fondly, it's kind of the last cultural movement that took place.
Historically, the East Village has been central to nearly every major alternative or underground scene in the U.S., especially from the 19th and 20th centuries. That includes creative enclaves in performance, like the Yiddish Theater District, and the New Yorkian Cultural Platform and Poets Cafe, established by people born of Puerto Rican descent living in New York. Punk magazine's Holmstrom maintains creative people who flocked to the city and the neighborhood were part of a long legacy of those seeking new and often unorthodox outlets.
It was very uncool to live in New York City in the early 70s. People thought I was nuts when I moved here. So I think the people who came to New York were really dedicated to the tradition of New York, the birth of punk. And they started with kind of the anti-hippies in the hippie movement, you know, David Peel, the Fugs, Velvet Underground, the New York bands. The New York City was very unfriendly to hippies. Hippies hated New York. New York hated hippies. That was kind of the beginning of a punk attitude.
That's another first wave band, the Tough Darts. The East Village also has a long tradition of political and social activism. Examples include the first free black settlement organized in the 1600s, as well as the Progressive Reform Era, which developed because of terrible living conditions and overcrowded slums located throughout the Lower East Side. Certainly, any discussion of the dynamic political activism in the East Village must include the Yippies or the Youth International Party, established in late 1967, and whose headquarters was practically across the street from CBGB, off the Bowery. Other factors played a role as well, like the financial crisis during the 1970s. New York City was particularly impacted. Do you remember that famous tabloid headline which read, "Ford's New York City Dropped Dead," from 1975, in which the president rejected giving federal assistance to the city, which was on the cusp of bankruptcy and default? The Lower East Side and East Village were especially vulnerable to the downswing. Here's Vinky Philip and The Planet. Avenue, that brings me another view. one-time punk magazine music editor, Elon Wilder, eventually became its associate publisher.
It was a time when Citibank wrote, "People have no jobs." People were wearing ripped jeans, not as a fashion statement, but because they couldn't afford to buy another pair. They were wearing those white skip sneakers because they were a dollar at Woolworths. And, you know, we have to put this in perspective. Most of these people were estranged from their parents. The rent was like $50 a month downtown. That's why people were down there.
Dear France emphasizes it was definitely a choice at the time to go to CBGB.
You know, we were rough and rowdy there. There weren't any Girl Scouts at CBGB's. There really wasn't. It was a rough crowd, man. It really was. I mean, because it was in the middle of nowhere. So you had to really want to be there. You know, you had to really want to be there.
CBGB was never considered a palace, despite the name of the single room occupancy or SRO hotel positioned above the club. This type of housing is also called lodging houses or, more pejoratively, flop houses. Moreover, CBGB was never regarded as spatial, with a capacity for only several hundred. It's former CBGB's employee and server, Liz Kurtzman, who worked at the club between 1975 and 1978.
There was a funny night when Patti Smith played, and it was so packed you couldn't move, and I was a waitress then. You would have like a tray of 12 beers and they would all fall down. And finally, Merv and Hilly just said, "Just stop. Stop serving. You can't serve like this." And I used to wear high heels to waitress, and what I was thinking.
On a floor that wasn't even.
Right. It was stupid. They were just like, "Just forget it. We don't care. We're not making any money. We don't care. Just stop." My favorite thing at CBGB's was the very early part of my time there. Some nights, if the weather was bad or if it was a weeknight, there would be 10 people in the club to see the Talking Heads. There's a front part of the bar. I used to sneak back there and like, I was in heaven. How lucky was I to see, the Talking Heads or television? Nobody there. I was so lucky.
This is television. At the outset, everything within CBGB was on the same ground level. A pool table was positioned on the club's right side, en route to the bathrooms and kitchen. Standing nearby was the piano, which once belonged to Crystal's mother. Musician Dear France, who worked in several jobs at CB's, really appreciated that piano.
When I first went down there, the stage was on the other side. And we all hung around the pool table and played piano, and it was this very heady place. Oh, it's just dripping of sexual energy. It was fabulous. And Christian Hale was still on television. Oh, my God, just the lineup of those three men on the stage.
My goodness.
Birth paradise.
Lead singer for The Shirts, Artie LaMonica.
Well, it's fuzzy, but there are certain things that are, you know, indelible. I can imagine walking in there even now and just seeing the layout and how everything had its place. You walked in and there was the table with the whoever was at the door, and then pinball machine. It was the bar, and then you had the pool table all the way in the back, and you had the small stage. Especially visualizing the neon beer signs, you know, floating towards the stage, I always thought that was a great image of the place. And an unusual looking place. It was just like a subway car. Narrow and long, it was like, wow, it's like walking into the Corova Milk Bar, you know. It was like really wild to me personally.
You mean from Clockwork Orange?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it felt like this like wild kind of thing.
Lead singer for The Shirts, Artie LaMonica. And speaking of The Shirts, it's not necessarily a well-known fact that the stage made famous by the whirlwind created around CB's was actually its second. The origins of the first stage are not completely known, though there's speculation Haley most likely built it himself. According to the club's initial sound person, Harry Taxi Briel,
the first stage was 90 degrees of a circle in a corner. That was there before. That was a stage for one person with an acoustic guitar.
That first stage was pretty small, explains John Holmstrom from Punk Magazine.
The shirts were too crowded. The Ramones could barely fit on there. I remember seeing Talking Heads, and somehow they were a three-piece, but one song, Chris would leave the drums and play xylophone. So they were able to fit the drum kit, a xylophone, Tina, and Dave on the stage.
Barely or not, no exploration of CBGB would be complete without including the infamous bathrooms. The Bowler brothers, Howard and David, who founded the Marbles in 1974, continue to wonder about the club's facility.
That bathroom is still mystifying to me. There was no privacy. Plenty of drugs. We weren't really that concerned, I guess.
Occasionally people used to urinate in it.
The Marbles were another of the M bands. CBGB veterans, the Ryans, discuss the bathroom's regression, that is, if they indeed began in a somewhat pristine condition.
There was never a time when it wasn't bad.
Well, I can say that the men's room devolved, okay? There used to be, you know, like doors to the stall. Just little niceties like that that got ripped out and kicked apart. And you know, it was like every bad high schooler's bathroom or something.
Worse, way worse.
But I don't know. I can't speak to the ladies' room. Never.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't use it unless it was really necessary.
Even CBGB diehards, Tish and Snooki, creators of the socially conscious beauty brand Manic Panic, had some issues.
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, that was like... I don't know. It was like an adventure walking in men's room. That was like really like scary. That was that was so horror film. That was like really, you know, B film, like horror flick kind of bathroom. The men's, our friend in London would say, oh, it's the men's latrine. It smells like the men's latrine. And it did.
It did.
Corroborating the Marbles, the Belomo sisters described some of the bathroom's extracurricular activities.
You could always see a few pairs of feet in the stall next to you, and you knew they were up to something. It was either sex or drugs, and the rock and roll was upstairs. But it was either sex or drugs in the stall next to you. You'd see quite a few extra feet.
Crystal's daughter, Lisa, helped manage the club and its staff. Despite the conventional narrative, Lisa can attest to how much effort went towards keeping the bathrooms clean and functional.
And I keep saying my dad had people in to clean. He always had a good person cleaning. It was bleached. It was scrubbed. Upstairs, everything. And it was customers who broke toilets, who broke walls, garbage on the floor, who did everything. If you went in the daytime, it was clean. But the whole point is, it was those people who came in who thought they could do it. He rebuilt toilets, he rebuilt mirrors, he rebuilt sinks, he did everything. And within a week, everything was destroyed again.
Yes, another M band, this time Milk and Cookies. CB's physical space and the environs in which it resided most likely bolstered its appeal to a select group or type of community. Nonconformists, free spirits, the unconventional, people who weren't necessarily satisfied by mainstream society, whether by choice or not. CBGB spoke to them. The club was completely without pretense, and by most accounts, the opposite of elegant or glamorous. During interviews, the word dive and assorted variations of it came up a lot. B.G. Hacker was a singer who played CBs with his band roughly around 1975. Eventually, Hacker worked his way to becoming the club's night manager.
It's just divey bar. I mean, it was just CBGB. The Bowery at that time wasn't a very glamorous or safe place. It wasn't like going anywhere in the Village. It was a little bit dicey. And so it just sort of fit in. It wasn't a scary place, or it wasn't appealing or unappealing. It was, I guess, what you would expect there. It wasn't a surprise.
Photographer and former Revenge Girl Eileen Polk recalls what she encountered.
The first time I went to CBGB's was in 1972, before the awning was up. It was just a dive bar. It was pretty. It was dark and dingy. The floor was all uneven. You had to have a few drinks to navigate the floor, I think. The kitchen was filthy. I never ate the food there.
The Revenge Girls were a group of young women who declared their power within the heavily male-dominated scene, naming themselves after a local clothing store at which they worked called Revenge. It was located just below St. Mark's Place on 3rd Avenue, which is the extension of the Bowery above 4th Street near Cooper Square. The Revenge Girls are partially credited with creating the so-called punk look. Guitar player and songwriter Tom Winbrand.
I think it was 1972 or early 73, before it was even CBGB. It was called Hilly's. Same space, same dive. We played there with Wayne in Queen Elizabeth, and the audience was Hell's Angels. My first impression of CBGB's as CBGB's was it was a dive. We'd been playing wherever we could, of course, Broadway Charlie's. We had a regular Sunday night gig there. It wasn't as big as CB's, but it tended to be more crowded. And it was a nice, nice Sunday night gig. So now we're at CBGB, and basically the audience was the other bands. We all supported one another. We were the only ones interested in our music and our friends' music.
Winbrand co-founded M-Band, the Miamis, with his brother. Perhaps Ed Ryan from the group The Rudies sums it up best.
What were first impressions of the club? It was a dump.
Dump or dive, it's very clear CBGB was exactly what it was meant to be under the circumstances. The world became a richer, more interesting place, and for that we'll always be grateful. Though there's been a recent spate of losses to the punk, post-punk, and CBGB families, we're limited by time, so we'll focus on two. David Johansen, lead singer of the New York Dolls, undoubtedly a band without whom there would be no punk rock. And Blondie drummer Clem Burke, a much beloved, respected, and integral part of the CB's community. We leave you with a song truly reflecting Burke's virtuosity. That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to excerpts from our audio documentary, This Ain't No Disco, This Is CBGB, where punk rock originated. Engineering assistance came from Russ Henry. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio.
I'm Jillian Jonas in New York. Thank you for listening and see you next week on Sprouts.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hey there, KBOO listeners. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi, host of the new show, Radical Romance. Radical Romance is an advice show for folks who are in non-traditional relationships. Either you're in an open relationship or a polyamorous one, this is the show for you. Please call in. It airs every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 10 a.m. Look forward to hearing from you. That's Radical Romance on KBOO Community Radio.
Hello, I don't even know your name, but I'm hoping all the same. This is more than just a simple hello.
Today on Wings.
I always feel like local is where it's at. We are all part of the same ecosystem.
Environmental journalist